I like I just said, I gave a shiur on racial diversity a couple of weeks ago, and one of the points that I made in that shiur was about the potential for systemic bias within Judaism, and not in terms of racism in terms of a person's skin color, but biases on other grounds. And there was a lot of pushback within that shiur on this, and I thought, you know what, Parshas Korach is actually a good time to have this conversation. Korach is very different from the other problems in Sefer Bamidbar. Bamidbar has lots of cases of the Jews as a nation behaving inappropriately, right? Can you give me an example besides Korach?
But there is the story with the sons of Aaron.
That's in Sefer Vayikra.
Oh.
In Sefer Bamidbar. And I want something that involves a mass of people, not just like one or two people.
Well, when everybody's crying and...
Right, the Meraglim saying the Canaanim are too powerful for us and, you know, winning over a significant chunk of the people to their, you know, to their cause. How about 2 weeks ago in Baal Oscha, when they wanted meat and they criticized the miraculous mun that they were, this week, obviously, Korach and crew argue that Moshe and Aaron have created an insider club, taking leadership for themselves. Looking ahead in the end of Parshas Balak, the beginning of Parshas Pinchas, we find the Jewish men pursuing temptation with the women of Midian and Moab and even worshiping Baal Peor. So you have lots of cases in Sefer Bamidbar of Jews doing what they're not supposed to do. But most of those cases end one way, which is punishment, right? Whether it's the people who bite into the slav, the quail, or pheasant, or whatever that is, in Parshas Baal Oscha, or whether it's the death of the Meraglim and then that entire generation dying out over the next 40 years, there's a very clear ending to those stories. Punishment. Only in Korach's case does it end differently. If you take a look on your sheet, look at what happens here. And I didn't bring a translation for all of it. Nonetheless, I'm not going to read it out. You know, I just wanted you to have the psukim. Source number one talks about the fire pans. In Hebrew, the machtot. And what happens here is, after the initial objection that Korach and his crew bring, you're taking power for yourselves, Moshe proposes a showdown, a duel. He says, here's what we're going to do. You can all bring these fire pans, put ketores, put incense on them, and bring it before God, and Aharon will bring his own ketores. And let's see what happens. He tries to educate them, which we did not see with the other circumstances. And what happens, as brought in source number one, is that fire comes out and it consumes these 250 men who are bringing the ketores. And then we are told that we're supposed to take these pans and make them a plating of sorts for the mizbeach, for the altar, as a reminder for all time. So everybody should always remember what happened here. But we're not done. In source number two, we find that Moshe also went to Korach and tried to convince him to back down. Did not succeed. Went to Dathan and Aviram, or sent a message to Dathan and Aviram, and they said, we're not interested in having a conversation. And then in source number three, we find Korach and his crew getting swallowed up in the ground. This really startling, as I wrote on the sheet, it's a startling visual. The earth opening up and swallowing them, but very different from the sort of standard cases, like there's a plague or something like that. And Moshe himself says, I want something brand new and different for this situation. And then finally, in source number four, after all of that, we get an additional point in which they take a staff representing each of the tribes of Israel, including one from Levi. Ephraim and Manasseh are together under Yosef, so there are 12 staffs. And they leave them in the Ohel Moed. And the next morning, the one that has blossoms, flowers, almonds, that's the right one. That's the one that Hashem favors, and that's Aharon's staff. And there's a lot of discussion about which staff it was and where did this come from, but we're not doing that right now. The point is that they're then supposed to take this staff and leave it in the Mishkan as an eternal reminder of what has happened here. So you see how we treat this differently from the other cases? There are so many attempts to educate them. There are so many signs and miracles that are brought. Why should Korach's mutiny be treated so differently from the other sins of Sefer Bamidbar? It's not really fair for me to ask you, like, on a moment's notice. I thought a lot about this. You see the problem, right?
I feel like this is an attack on the actual leadership as opposed to the other problems that we've seen are more communal complaining.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this is really like wanting to, I don't know, like switch leaders or take
right.
over the power.
Right. So why would that warrant a reaction which seems more patient, you know, by trying to convince them? And is more demonstrative by having all these signs that everybody is supposed to see and they're supposed to keep. You're right about, you know, this being much more targeted at the leadership. It's just, I don't really follow why that would lead to this.
Because I feel like the people have to see slowly, why that change can't happen, or why it shouldn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if they do something obviously wrong, like, you know, like with the Meraglim, then there's, you know, like, you complain, you shouldn't have complained, you get a punishment. Like, it's more straightforward, whereas here, maybe the people have to be, like, they have to be convinced that there's actually a problem here. It's not so straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
Because if so many people were on board with this, maybe mm-hmm. they wanted that change, and that change would have been good. Maybe there are arguments for it.
Mm-hmm. Good. I'm going to come back to that. Liba.
Just like on along those lines, maybe it wasn't necessarily for Korach that they were trying to convince, but rather the people that hadn't yet followed him or potentially could follow him.
Mm-hmm.
And it was more like Korach will get his punishment, we're going to deal with that. But in case this is going to start to become like more of a global, you know, atmosphere or global mentality, they kind of have to like stop that in its tracks more on a global level and then deal with the Korach punishment kind of as like two different things.
Mm-hmm.
Not only deal with the punishment to eradicate the mentality, if you mean.
Right. So combining what both of you are saying, I think this fits with both of those ideas. I feel like what you're seeing here with Korach's complaint is a complaint that has traction. Because there is room for a legitimate claim like what Korach and his group are saying of potential abuse of power by leaders, exclusion of those who are outside the ruling class. That's actually, you know, a substantive concern within Judaism. The concern of God can't defeat Canaan is like, go home, guys. You know, that's not a thing. The complaint of the mun, you know, we don't like mun, this miraculous bread falling to us from the heavens. It's like, you know, come on. That's, you know, you're not serious. The going to the women of Midian and Moab and, you know, Peor also, like, there's nothing to educate them about. Like, they know that's wrong. So it's only here where there's really an educational point to be made. And that's where I wanted to go with this. We talked about this a little bit, actually, in Parshas Emor, not this year, but last year, I think, where we talked about the Megadef, the fellow who blasphemed against God. We talked about it also in Parshas Naso a couple of weeks ago, when we talked about Gezel Hager, someone who steals from someone who had converted to Judaism. But this time we'll see it as sort of a topic unto itself. So, in order to understand this, in order to understand why there's traction to what Korach says, you need to first ask what exactly is what today is popularly called systemic racism. I mean, I don't really like catchphrases and, you know, sort of popular code words, but I think the term is actually a really good and useful term. I would probably substitute the word bias for racism, because what we're going to be talking about here is not really about race. But we'll see that. I'm not reopening also the entire discussion that we've had before about racism. We did that Parshas Chayisara a couple of years ago with not marrying from Canaan. I just brought you two sources, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky and Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky calling racism an ugly trait. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik calling it loathsome barbarity. And we've already dealt with that topic, and I gave you a link in source number 7 for a shiur that I gave before Rosh Hashanah this year, racism in Rosh Hashanah, for those who want to have more of a discussion about that. I'm going to take as a given that we don't like racism. But what is the systemic character of it? What does the phrase systemic racism mean to you?
It's sort of embedded in society.
Yeah. True.
Probably that it's the entire, it's like coloring abroad, like including everyone in the group, not just saying some people of whatever Sephardim are, but like the entire group, every single Sephardi is this.
Mm-hmm.
It's everyone, no exception.
Right. So that's a part of it. The key thing to me, I mean, all of these things are valid, but the key thing to me to understand is that systemic racism is unintentional. In other words, the people who are engaged in it are not racist. They're not. It's not that they don't like people of a particular ethnicity. It's not that they won't do business with them or, you know, won't have them in their homes or whatever. That's not what we're saying. What we're talking about is where you have people who are not racist at all. However, the overall system and way society operates naturally is going to disadvantage certain people. Without it ever being anybody's goal. I brought you a piece from the National Post in source number 8. This was at the time when Doug Ford said, no, there's no racism in Canada, or there's no systemic racism in Canada. So the National Post published an article, or it's, you see the editorial board. There is broad national confusion about this concept. The suggestion that Canadian society is racist can sound insulting, because if Canada is racist, then Canadians themselves must be racist and full of hate. This sense of insult is an obstacle to understanding what systemic racism means. A claim about society blurs into a claim about an individual. Systemic racism can come across as an accusation. One way out of this mess is to get over oneself, meaning it's not about you. And if you flip the sheet, the idea of systemic racism, and this I bolded because it's the key line, is not about individual attitudes. It is about how society works. Good people can participate in systemic racism. As an Ontario Superior Court judge put it this month, sentencing a 25-year-old black man on gun charges, the offender's life prospects were limited from birth by poverty and anti-black racism in his Canadian society. This was not simply the usual vicissitudes and general unfairness of life, it was systemic and structural. So the idea here is that it's not about being racist. It's just about the system working in favor of some over others. I'll give you an example from the shiur I gave for lawyers. The fact that accreditation materials in Canada are published without translation online. So people who want to know how to get here and what to do and how to recertify in law have to already have English. Now, some will respond and say, well, if you want to practice law here, it's probably a good idea to have English anyway. Nonetheless, you're putting people at a disadvantage unintentionally. It's not the goal, but it happens. You know, as an example of that. Or another example was, the law has articling requirements, right? So, there was a case which came before a review board of someone who was Chinese speaking who wanted to qualify as a criminal lawyer and wanted to accelerate the articling requirements because they had already practiced in China. And the response of the review board was, we already have plenty of Chinese-speaking lawyers. We don't need to accelerate it. And the person who wrote the article said, that's true that you have a lot of Chinese-speaking lawyers. However, you don't have a lot of Chinese-speaking criminal lawyers. This is a fellow who's in the field who said, I don't even know of one. They tend to go into different areas of law, which means if you have somebody who is accused of a crime who only speaks Chinese, they're not going to find someone from their cultural background. Now, you'll say, well, so somebody else can represent them. But you know full well that people try to find in certain areas, real estate agents, you know, doctors, lawyers. People do want to find somebody who they feel understands them. That's just true. So it's not something intentional. No one in that review board is biased against people from China. But the result of that system is that the people from China who are accused of a crime are not going to be able to get a criminal lawyer who speaks their language and who understands their culture. You follow? So those are examples. And my argument is that you can see this within Judaism as well. Again, not in terms of color, because we've already noted and discussed elsewhere, that's one that Judaism really doesn't have patience for. But in other ways, based on what could be called insider and outsider. First, we'll go back to Parshas Emor and the story of the Megadef. So if you remember the story, and I think actually, did I bring it here on the sheet? Hang on. Yeah, I brought it in source number 9. There was a man who was the son of an Israelite woman, son of an Egyptian man. He went out among the children of Israel. And there was a fight in the camp, the son of the Israelite woman who we just mentioned, and an Israelite man. And the Midrash in the Sifra, in source number 10, expands on the story. I'm going to say it outside of the Sifra, just to be a little more clear, I think, than the text itself. What happened was, this fellow whose father was Egyptian and whose mother was Jewish wanted to set up his tent in the camp of Dan, because that was where his mother's Shevet was. That was his mother's tribe. However, the people of Dan said, you don't belong here. Your father's Egyptian, and the tribal identity is associated with the father, so you don't get a share in Shevet Dan. So he goes to Moshe to seek help, and he loses the case, because what they're saying is correct. You don't get. And that leads him to go out from Moshe's court and to blaspheme against God, and the story goes from there. So Moshe is certainly not a person of bias. You can't accuse Moshe of that. However, the system itself is designed to privilege the family over the outsider. Right? Anytime you set up a system in which there are tribes, and the tribes get their portions, you're excluding those who don't fit. You know, not intentionally, but it's true. Family over outsider. And I brought you in source number 11, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, which we saw in Parshas Naso, made the same point. In Parshas Naso, we learned the law of Gezel Hager. Right? What happens if somebody steals from somebody who converted to Judaism? The person who converted to Judaism did not marry and have a family within the Jewish people and passed away. And now the thief wants to pay it back. How does he pay it back? So we learn in Parshas Naso that he gives it to the Kohanim. And we had a whole shiur about that. We're not reopening that discussion right now about how it's done. But what's odd is that this section really didn't belong in Parshas Naso. It belonged back in Sefer Vayikra. Because in Vayikra, they talked about some of the laws that relate to this and just stopped short of this Gezel Hager law. They talked about bringing a carbon if somebody stole, and then there's a whole discussion there. That's really where this belonged. Not in Parshas Naso. So Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, in source number 11, says the following. While Judaism sees the family and the nation as central to Jewish identity and consciousness, it is well aware of the danger to which these loyalties can lead when taken to an extreme. It is for this reason that we are commanded with regard to Gezel Hager in the middle of Parshas Naso. It is precisely the ger, the foreigner, lacking the sense of familial, tribal, and national roots, who is most vulnerable to the atmosphere pervading the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar, because Bamidbar starts all about tribes, which tribes travel together, what the flags are of the tribes, the order in which they travel. It's all centered around family. There's a census of families. So Rav Aaron says that's the concern. The concern is that because your focus is so oriented around family, the ger is an outsider, becomes vulnerable. Therefore, the Torah commands us here to deal with the ger exactly as we would with our fellow Israelites. So this is one potential problem. The emphasis on family over outsider. Clear? Second possibility, the preference for the righteous over those who are not righteous. And I brought you a Gemara in Sanhedrin, which we actually discussed way back when we talked about Amalek. If you take a look at source number 12, the Torah gives the lineage of the family of Esav. And it mentions Achos Lotan Timnah. The sister of Lotan was a woman by the name of Timnah. And it's very strange. That whole verse is very strange. And then the text goes on to say that Timnah was a pilegesh for Eliphaz, son of Esav. She was a concubine for the son of Esav. So the Gemara asks, why is she mentioned here, this Timnah? And what's this about? Maihi, who was she? Timnah bas malachim havoi. Timnah was a daughter of kings. Because the text says, aluf lotan, aluf Timnah. It actually lists the alufim. V'chol aluf malchusa b'lo tagahi. And an aluf is, as they call it in the Gemara, an uncrowned empire. It means it was like a big clan. So she was from the leadership of a large family. How did she become a concubine then? Baya le'igyure. She wanted to convert to Judaism. Basa etzel Avram Yitzchak v'Yaakov. V'lo kibluwa. She comes to Avram. She comes to Yitzchak. She comes to Yaakov, and they're not interested. She doesn't warrant it. Even though they are, you know, bringing people in, certainly Avram and Sarah are bringing people in, they're not willing to accept her. So, So she became a pilegish for Eliphaz instead, and she has a son with Eliphaz who is Amalek. And what the Gemara is saying here, as it concludes, they should not have distanced her. So the point here is that we do privilege the righteous over those we label as not righteous. Timnah got labeled as not righteous, and therefore she wasn't allowed in. Am I going too quickly, or we're good? Okay. You know you have options on the Zoom under reactions. You can do like faster or slower, all sorts of neat stuff. Okay. And then the third example, related to the second one, is privilege of the learned over the unlearned. Aside from privileging those who are righteous, but we privilege those who have studied Torah. I'll give you an example. Source number 13. The Gemara talks about helping the business of a Talmid Chacham. Kol hamatil malai lekis talmidei chachamim. Anyone who provides merchandise for a Torah scholar, zoche v'yoshe b'yeshiva shamala, will merit to sit in the Heavenly Academy. What it's talking about is where he has a business. So you set him up with merchandise that he can sell, and then he'll be able to pay you back. That's considered a meritorious thing to do. We want to benefit those who are learned. But the flip side of that is that the unlearned person feels excluded. Right? They're helping him out. They're not helping me out. So there's, you know, we have this threat. Same thing is expressed in the story of Rabbi Akiva. If you take a look at source number 14. Amar Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva said, Kishayisi Am Haaretz. When I was in Am Haaretz, before I started learning, Amarti, I would say, Miyiten li Talmud Chacham v'ana shchenu kachamor. I wish that somebody would give me a Talmud Chacham, I would bite him like a donkey. Amar lo Talmidav, his student said to him, Rabbi, I'm more like a Kelev, you should say like a dog, not like a donkey. The unclear why that's preferential, that, yeah, that's preferred, nonetheless. Amar lahen is zen no sheikh v'shover etzem, v'zen no sheikh v'eno shover etzem. There's a difference, because one bites and breaks a bone, and the other one bites and does not break a bone. In other words, I wanted to be the one, like the donkey, who would bite and break bones. That's how much I hated Talmidei Chachamim, says Rabbi Akiva. Well, Tosfos has a problem with that. Rabbeinu Tam has an issue with that, as I brought in source number 15. Because Rabbi Akiva, even before he learned Torah, was great. Rabbi Akiva was not a terrible person at that stage. We know, the Gemara says, that when Rachel, the daughter of Kalba Savua, she's named Rachel in Abbas to Rabbi Nassan, when Rachel sees him, she sees that he has good midos, that he has good attributes. We have other sources to support that as well. So Rabbeinu Tam explains, if you look at source 15, the English is at the top of the next slide. When Psachim says, Rabbi Akiva said, right, you see that there, I wish someone would give me a Talmud Chacham and I would bite him like a donkey, which sounds as though he was bad. One could say that it was not that he hated Talmidei Chachamim, but rather that he thought they were arrogant to Amei Haaretz because of their Torah, and the Talmidei Chachamim hated them. He felt they look down on us. Also, because they would not permit Amei Haaretz to touch them because of issues of Tumah and Tahara, they would always hold themselves apart from the Amei Haaretz. So, you're seeing a society in which those who are learned are going to treat the unlearned differently. You follow? So, my argument is that Hashem is well aware that people who feel that they are on the outside could really argue that the system is biased against them. The system is biased against people who don't come from the right family, the ger, or, you know, the case of the fellow in the Midbar, where his mother was Jewish, but his father was not. The system is biased against, you could argue, people who are not righteous. You could argue that the system is biased against people who are unlearned, and therefore Hashem has to take the time to address it. Even though Korach is entirely wrong, nonetheless, you have to take the time to address it. And so Hashem takes the time to do so in the Parsha. You follow? I suppose to this we could even add Kohen, Levi, you know, other privileges that show up. You could argue men versus women in terms of certain roles within Torah as well. So that's what I see happening in Parshas Korach. But Torah works to prevent this problem. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 16 about creation of the Mishkan, the Medrash in Shmos Rabbah notes, who is it who's in charge of creating the Mishkan? Who was in charge? Anybody know? So the Mishkan is created by Bezalel and Aholiyav. Bezalel is from the tribe of Yehuda. Aholiyav is from the tribe of Dan. They're opposite ends. Yehuda is from Leah. Dan is from Bilha, the Shivcha of Rachel. Yehuda is traveling at the head of the Jews. Dan is the Ma'asef. They're the one who gathers everybody in at the end. The two of them are matched together to build the Mishkan, as this Medrash in Shmos Rabba notes, in order to make a statement. Further, you find it with the building of the first Beis HaMikdash. Who was the builder of the Beis HaMikdash among the Jews? Well, not among the Jews. Who was the leader of building the first Beis HaMikdash? Whose idea was it?
Shlomo
HaMelech. Shlomo HaMelech, right? Shlomo HaMelech. Well, Shlomo made use of a fellow by the name of Chiram. Not the same as Chiram, king of Tzor. He's a different person. But there's a fellow, Chiram, who is described as the son of a widow from Naphtali. Again, Naphtali being one of those that's from Bilha, the Shivcha. And not only that, we don't find out about his father, and Abarbanel suggests his father was not Jewish. The two of them are paired together to build the first Beis HaMikdash. So what we're trying to do, as the Medrash here notes, is to bring people back in together. Gemara in Sukkah, in source number 17, says to you, every single Shevet produced a Shofet, produced one of the Shoftim during that era after Yehoshua up until the beginning of the monarchy. And every single Shevet produced at least one Navi. Every Shevet produces that. Now, when it comes to the kings, right, we start out with Binyamin and then jump to Yehuda and that's it. That's worth discussing at some point. But the point here is, it's scattered among the nation, and we're trying to avoid that type of systemic preference for one particular group. It comes up in Halacha also. I brought you in source 18 and source 19, two Isurim, two prohibitions. One, Lo sekalel cheresh velifnei iver lo sitein mechshol. Don't curse the deaf. Don't put a stumbling block in front of the blind. If someone has a disadvantage, don't, you know, take advantage of that. And then in source number 19, Viger lo sone velo silchatzenu. Don't abuse the stranger. Don't oppress the stranger. I brought you source number 20. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a classic tshuva where he deals with the issue of people who have developmental disabilities coming to shul. And he says you have to make sure to welcome them. There's a lot to be discussed, what happens if it's disruptive and so on, but that's not the point right now. The point is, he says, you have to make sure that they will feel welcome there in the shul, that their parents will feel welcome bringing them to the shul. We try to embrace. So what I'm getting at here overall is, number one, Korach's claim is categorically different from the other claims in Sefer Bamidbar. The other claims don't have any merit. God can't beat Canaan. That's a joke. This claim was wrong when he launched it against Moshe, but it is one which may well come up within Judaism. And so the Torah takes the time to actually address it, recognizing it, because we have privilege of family over outsider, privilege of righteous over not righteous, privilege of the learned over the unlearned, not because of anybody's ill will, not because anybody's out to hurt people, but because it's native to the system. And so what the Torah wants us to learn here is to take those steps, like in the last sources that we brought, of not harming and instead welcoming everyone, and in order to defeat this. You follow? Everyone was so quiet today.
A lot to think about.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Feel better.